Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Strategy Series. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today are two good friends, Sam Pendet of the Center for Naval Analyses. He's also affiliated with the Center for a New American Security, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's one of the world's leading experts on Russia, the Russian military, as well as unmanned systems. And Dr. Eugene Rumer, the director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also served as the former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia on the National Intelligence Council. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us again, and welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we get started, our coverage of strategy, strategic issues, and conversations with leading thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. The strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Guys, Sam, I think we're going to start with you on this. For months, Ukraine's supporters have argued that without more aid, Ukraine will not just lose ground, but even possibly lose the war. And we're getting that sense now. Dr. Jack Watling of the Royal United Services Institute sent on this program early in this conflict that history has proven that defeats start slow and then rapidly accelerate. So even the moment where you think you might be losing, you might actually be losing. Just like when we saw the dynamic of Russia's losses, it looked slow, and then they rapidly accelerated, and Ukraine gained back a lot of ground. Congress delayed aid for so long that Ukraine has been losing its most precious commodity, which is its soldiers, and at a dramatically accelerated pace because of a lack of ammunition. And we knew this in October when we were warning that Ukraine needs more aid. The Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, General Cavoli, NATO's top officer, told Congress last week that the side with more bullets wins, the side with less bullets loses. And that's where we are. And meanwhile, the Russians have been fielding more capability, new glide bombs, and other systems that are devastating what is already a thin Ukrainian line. And in the wake of Iran's attack on Israel, Congress is finally going to vote this week on more aid, but in a fragmented way where Israel might pass, but the outlook for Ukraine aid is still uncertain. And if, you know, my fear is if we don't make this aid available immediately and get it there in time, it might be too late when fighting season starts. Sam, as I said, start us off. Each week you join us, we talk about the territorial losses and retreats are relatively minor, but there are a lot of places where Russia has been making a lot of progress in the last week or two. Walk us through where we are and, you know, what the Ukrainians are doing using unmanned systems. I mean, they're trying to use unmanned systems to make up for a lack of artillery and air power, but it's not clear whether or not it's making a difference. Where are we?
Well, most of the movements and most of the territory exchanged in Ukraine is incremental, but Russians are making gains west of Bakhmut towards Chasiv Yar. And it's a small city, just like Bakhmut is, but it would give Russians another sort of victory to celebrate, even if the victory is rather minor and they've wasted enormous amount of resources to get it. We've talked for months about Russian ability to take casualties. We've talked for months about Russian ability to reconstitute its force in the face of Ukrainian stiff defense. But it appears that despite the losses, the manpower, the materiel, the weapons, the systems, the tanks, the armored vehicles, Russians are simply determined to continue fighting. And just as Ukrainians are calling for more aid, just as they're seeing how U.S. aid to Ukraine is part of the political football here, Russians are feeling more and more confident that they can continue pressing on. And that's exactly what's happening across the entire front.
Eugene, how worried should people in Washington be, given where we are right now? And frankly, again, Putin has had a pretty good swing in his step. I mean, his disinformation is working so well. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, a stalwart Republican, Mike Turner, is warning of Russian messaging being parroted by his caucus. And we're still not assured as we record this that aid is going to pass. How dire is the situation now as far as you're concerned?
Based on what Sam just said and based on what we're reading day to day, hour to hour, what's happening on Capitol Hill, the situation is very grave. There's no question about it. I'm not saying anything new here. And you know, there are two categories of people in Washington, some who do care, others who don't. And clearly there's a minority of people on Capitol Hill not just on Capitol Hill, but minority of people in our electorate who don't really care, who don't think that we should be spending money on supporting Ukraine or probably, many other countries. I do believe that there's a lot at stake here. I'm sure as many of your listeners do too. But given the nature of our domestic political situation, I don't see a resolution to this anytime soon. So yes, we should be very worried about it. I'm not quite sure what is to be done about this situation at this present moment, other than to just watch and hope.
What are the implications of a Russian win, like an outright Russian win, and what would that look like in your guys' sense? Is it that they just break the line, they gain some ground, do they go directly to Kyiv? What does the shape of this look like? A failing of the Ukrainian line, how deep do the Russians get? I mean, is it taking Chasiv Yar, or is it actually getting back dozens or tens of miles? Sam, do you want to start that off?
Well,
and then maybe on a geostrategic level, Eugene, you give us the sense on the message that sends the rest of the world. Go ahead, Sam. Sorry about interrupting.
Sure. I think for the last 6 months or so, we've heard Russian government and Russian president basically switch the narrative from building on current gains to essentially a total victory. And what they mean by that is that there cannot be an independent Ukraine or a part of independent Ukraine in Russian government's thinking about this war. Ukraine must be essentially absorbed into the Russian sphere completely and directly. That's the line from the Kremlin. Because even if there is some kind of peace where there's a rump Ukraine or part of Ukraine is independent, Russia is concerned that it would be used as yet another sort of area from which to launch anti-Russian activities in general. And so for Putin, for Medvedev, for other members of Russian government, the narrative is now sort of the conquest of all of Ukraine and everything that stems from that. Cultural conquest, obviously economic conquest, industrial conquest, and of course military conquest. At the same time, Russian president is signaling that he's not interested in the war with NATO. He just wants all of Ukraine, full stop. And that is why Ukrainians are very concerned, because if the situation at the front does not change soon, as you have indicated, as lots of Ukrainian officials have indicated, the situation can, in fact, turn for the worse.
Eugene, your sense, and whether or not we should believe that Putin is going to stop. You know what I mean? He's obviously making a positive message. Hey, just let me get Ukraine. I won't be a threat to all of you. Do you believe that at all? I mean, what are the stakes, and what does a Russian victory look like? And then should we believe Vladimir Putin saying, I'm not interested in Estonia or parts of Poland or any Transnistria or anything else?
Look, I think a Putin victory would be a major setback for the United States. Having said on many occasions, our leaders have said on many occasions that we will stay with this for as long as it takes. And the fact that we're now failing to support Ukraine speaks a lot to U.S. credibility or the lack thereof and willingness to stand by our friends. And of course, the term stand by can be interpreted in different ways. That said, I think the Chinese would think other countries would feel the same way. So this could trigger a number of unpleasant consequences in the Pacific, in Latin America, in Africa, and so on. This is not to say that suddenly countries will flock to Russia's camp and become friends of Russia, but I think they will feel much more emboldened to pursue their own little geopolitical adventures and basically disregard the United States to a greater degree than they have been willing to do so far. The one thing that I find perhaps to be, you know, somewhat of a silver lining here is that European attitudes toward Russia are changing. And I don't really expect that Europe will go back to basically trying to rebuild the common European home. I think the Russians have really proven that they are a threat to Europe, will be for a long time. And if this is not a permanent condition, certainly a long-term condition. Will Putin want to grab Estonia or Latvia? I don't necessarily think so. I think that we will see much greater resolve in eastern, northern parts of Central Europe to kind of stiffen the spine of the alliance in the European Union to really restore some of the old Cold War habits in Europe that we thought were relegated to the past. So, well, I do see some glimmer of hope there.
Sam, let me take you to, let's assume that Congress today passes an aid package, right? How soon before the ammunition gets in the hands of the folks who need them? I mean, Sirski and his commanders have already laid out a bleak picture. If it takes 10 men, as it was quoted in a New York Times article, to defend 100 meters of front, some units are down to 2 people to defend 20 meters of front. That leaves 80 meters exposed, right? And the Russians know that. Will more artillery help plug that manpower shortage? I mean, what are the capabilities they immediately need systems-wise that can help sort of stem whatever Russian tide is heading their way?
Well, the requirements haven't changed, and we talked about it for months. Ukrainians want artillery because of its devastating effect against incoming infantry, mechanized infantry, manpower, and all kinds of military systems that move on the battlefield. That's the number one ask from the Ukrainians. And that's what's that's quickly becoming in short supply across the world because of absolute massive use. Russians don't seem to have that problem. And they're just firing at the Ukrainian positions. It doesn't matter if the strikes are accurate or not. Artillery strikes are military weapon. It's also a psychological weapon. It's a terror weapon. It can kill. It can also damage and maim. So it is effective and nothing replaces it. Ukrainians did talk about using FPV drones at tactical distances of up to several kilometers as precise strikes, as surrogates for artillery shells. But those drones do not really replace artillery. And so Ukrainian list also includes electronic warfare systems. It includes counter UAS systems and air defense systems. Again, that list hasn't changed since last year. And the Ukrainians are sounding alarm that they actually need this yesterday and the day before, and not just today.
And we should point out that the Czech Republic deserves an enormous amount of credit for digging up 155 rounds, 152 rounds, and trying to get as much of them over to the Ukrainians as well. Sort of one of these instances that it's like, wait a minute, the United States might not actually be stepping into the breach, and let's try to do something about this. And it's unclear at what point those weapons will be getting there either, and whether or not they will get there in time. Eugene, the delay in U.S. aid, right, it's a cascading effect, right? So Ukrainian casualty rates go up because they don't have as many weapons. They're losing their most precious commodity. They've been trying to safeguard the younger population because they have a demographic problem, right? A shortfall in birth rates around the time when the Soviet Union collapsed. And now they have to adopt new draft laws that are very unpopular, which are then destabilizing Zelensky. And Russia's fantasy is to get rid of Zelensky and get a more pro-Russian leader in there. And obviously a lot of disinformation efforts are focused on that. What is the impact that this is happening on Ukraine's leadership, its cohesion, and how strong is that cohesion now? I mean, right, everybody deserves a lot of credit for still being united, but fissures are forming and nothing succeeds like success, right? And that's not exactly what's happening now, even if leaders had warned last year that 24 was going to be a tough year.
Oh, sure. But I think we can credit both the people of Ukraine and the leadership of the country for maintaining not always a united front, but you know, the degree of cohesion and the degree of resolve that really is nothing short of admirable. Look, you know, one of the things that we sometimes tend to forget about Ukraine is that its politics for the past 30 years or so since independence has been very chaotic, but it's also been very democratic. Ukrainian elections have been very dirty, but also, you know, free and fairly contested. Maybe not always fairly contested, but certainly always contested. And I think that nature, you know, the kind of democratic, open nature of Ukrainian politics is manifesting itself nowadays. So there are always going to be differences, even at the most difficult moments when nations really have to come together among various factions and leaders. I would say that to the present moment, at present, Ukrainians have really been admirably united, and the resolve is still strong, considering especially the kind of trauma, physical and psychological, that's been inflicted on the country. When you read these reports like the one in the New Yorker about these soldiers in the front lines, you just wonder what these people are going through, how much longer can they hold on? And you talk about people who now have to live in cities without electricity, running water, you know, just even the most basic necessities, yet maintain their spirit. It is just remarkable.
Well, I would note that in Washington today, it's a beautiful day, and I would like members of Congress to bear that in mind. The hardship that millions of people are experiencing, and a situation that's been compounded and made worse by our inaction, our willful inaction. Let me just ask one quick thing, right? So if there's a breakthrough, do you guys, how far do you think the Russians can go before they're stopped? Or is this a situation where actually once the Russians break through, things could move a lot more quickly, unfortunately, right? What are the scenarios people need to bear in mind? And then there are a couple of other questions, obviously, we've got to discuss, but I'm intrigued by this. How far do they penetrate? Is this sort of, we expended 16,000 dead to take Avdiivka. We lost 8,000 to take Chasin Yar. Or when they break through, do they actually do damage and take back much, much more territory?
As Sam said before, and you pointed out, these things are unpredictable. So, you know, we can speculate whether they'll move toward Odessa or will aim for Kyiv or will just be content with some more significant but still incremental changes. But I think that, you know, the tragic piece here is that Putin doesn't even need to launch a new massive offensive against Ukraine. He can still just keep lobbying these glide bombs and other munitions at Ukrainian infrastructure, at power stations, at cities and towns. And the fact that they're not accurate, that these are not precision weapons, may be even more terrifying because of the constant danger that the civilian population has to live with. So, you know, he can just continue doing this in an open-ended manner, with Ukraine really needing desperately the air defenses to counter that. But it's not even clear that those air defenses really exist in the physical form that we really need to manufacture them.
Well, that's for sure. And we're still moving way, way, way too slow. I mean, the thing that bothers me about this is every signal we're sending is we're just not serious. And so when people talk about China or anything else, here was a pressing case. You drew that line and said what was at stake, and then we're still not producing things nearly fast enough to the point where our barrels are so empty we're worried about shipping our own capability over there now. Sam, let me put this question to you or whichever one of you want to really take this, right? I mean, Mike Turner's point about Russian messaging being repeated. This is something, you know, by members of Congress, right? They know better. They've been briefed. They know exactly what the situation is. They all know that, you know, the Ukrainian leader is not a Ukrainian Nazi, right? Does it, as two people familiar with Washington, are you guys at all surprised that this messaging has gained the kind of traction it has? And moreover, how do you counter this kind of messaging? Because people will believe their member of Congress saying this. I mean, as outlandish and ridiculous as we may think it is, if you're building a systemic campaign, it doesn't get any better than having America's leading elected officials or among popular effective officials or people who grab the microphone to be saying this stuff. So are you surprised? And then what's the counter to it, effectively?
Well, to a certain extent, it's not surprising. There's no such thing as a kind of a common definition of a member of Congress, right? Here we're talking about the elected officials themselves, right? Their personalities, their backgrounds, their ability to comprehend what's going on. And obviously, they are playing to their constituents, whether it's a safe district and they can practically do whatever they want, whether it's a contested district and sort of they have to appeal to both sides, right, who may not have elected them at once, obviously. So there are some members of Congress who are very well educated, who are very well aware, who take the time, who do the homework, who surround themselves with people who know a lot of issues, who turn to the tools available to them, beginning with their own congressional committees staffed by experts, to the likes of Congressional Research Service, to the think tank and policy community in Washington. There's plenty of members like that. And then there are members who don't necessarily do any of that or do that very incrementally because that's what they think is right. And so with 450 members of Congress or thereabouts, it is impossible to educate everyone. And it is impossible to lay out a detailed explanation of what's going on for every one of them. And that's how basically slip through the cracks and take hold in the minds and the narratives of some of these members of Congress. A lot of what they're saying is also not necessarily directed at sort of the larger public, but at their fellow members, especially if there's a split within the party and there's a contest for leadership, or if there's any other issue that splits the political party, and therefore some members are using regular narratives or outside narratives to sort of make their point. It's a very difficult question to answer. It's probably been like that for a very, very long time. And we may just be aware of it simply because every little thing that every member of Congress can say appears on social media almost instantaneously. And we're just bombarded with that type of information. Again, it really depends on how members are educated. And so it's up to the leadership of either political party to educate their fellow members of Congress and to make sure that they get information that has been vetted by U.S. government departments and entities, by the intelligence community, so that when they say things publicly, they actually say things that matter and that have meaning. Again, beyond that, it really depends on each individual member of Congress and their respective district.
Eugene, how do you stem the useful idiot tide?
I don't believe it's a problem that can be solved in the near term. You know, when you still, especially now, have a large segment of the population that believes that the 2020 election was stolen, people who now claim that with a straight face that on January 6, 2021, those were not rioters, but or insurrectionists, but simply tourists marching through the Capitol. I don't know what else there is to say. I mean, there are people who are willing to outright lie. And those who are, you know, plain given to conspiracy theories. I have no answer to the question, really, other than better education. That's that.
That's terrifying.
Sorry to disappoint.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure, Eugene, I have any better answer.
You have some of the most prominent members of our legislative branch, like, for example, John Kennedy, asking in a confirmation hearing a woman who was born in Kazakhstan, are you a socialist or are you a communist? Knowing full well that she's not, but just exploiting that. You know, how do you deal with that? And he's a highly educated, trained lawyer.
As it doesn't look like we're going to solve that problem, let me try to get you guys both, and we're kind of running short on time, but it's two questions to each of you. First, obviously, Iran attacked Israel, 300 ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, as well as explosive drones like the Shahed that Tehran has made available to the Russians, and the Russians have used to great effect on Ukraine. It was an extraordinary coalition that came together to defend Israel, United States, UK, France, Jordan, other nations that sort of all played a role in keeping these weapons from hitting Israel. And again, expended some of our own stocks, right? I mean, there's a concern that the Iranians are getting the Houthis to do this to help the Chinese by depleting our own inventories. And indeed, I don't know how much more evidence you need that these four, Iran, North Korea, Russia, and China are actually in collusion. Janet Yellen warned Beijing, don't help Russia. The next day, Lavrov shows up, and basically China says, we have an endless friendship. Eugene, you know, where is this going? What were the lessons from that? What does it mean in terms of geo strategy when we see an episode like this?
I don't believe that these are truly strategic partnerships, let alone alliances, but they do have strategic implications. And they certainly serve the interests of the parties involved. And they do have a, you know, shared objective of resisting what they see as the United States being kind of a global hegemonic power with incredible overreach. In a sense, there's a certain symmetry between Russia and China in that both see the United States as kind of meddling in its own front yard. So, I think we can expect to see more of it. I don't believe, for example, that, you know, the Chinese are really all that unhappy with, as some people claim, with what the Russians are doing in Ukraine. Chinese feel all that embarrassed by aligning with the Russians. They clearly are deriving significant geopolitical and economic interests from the relationship. And having, Russia as a junior partner with no other partnerships to turn to, with nowhere else to go, I think is not a bad thing. Russia having to sell its commodities to China at a significant discount, China being able to dictate the terms when it decides to do so for the second gas pipeline. What's there not to like?
Sam, your sense?
I agree with Eugene. Again, just a lot of very difficult questions that don't really have a lot of readily available answers at this point.
Let me take you both to sort of the how this ends or how to forestall or change the end. What does the end of this look like? I understand that it might not be that clear, but at some point, you know, Emmanuel Macron gets beaten up for this, but he is broaching something important that at some point we may need to intervene to stop this, to stop Ukraine's collapse. It's still a sovereign nation. It's under attack by an aggressor. And we have unfortunately played to that aggressor's, right? You can't get involved. Why can't we involve? We're sovereign nations. It's a sovereign nation. What form does this take? What form do we need to think about? Fate we need to think about forestalling that's a trigger. And then finally, does this end up as East Ukraine, West Ukraine, and we try to starve and sanction East Ukraine to the point where 40, 50 years from now, East Ukraine looks at West Ukraine, just like East Germany looked at West Germany and said, they're pretty prosperous over there. And I'm on a 3-year waiting list for a plastic trabant? Eugene and then Sam.
Look, I choose to be optimistic and put aside the scenario where Ukraine outright collapses. And I think that the next critical steps should be for the Allies and the United States. And I do believe that the United States ultimately will come through with some sort of a package. But for the Allies taken together to provide Ukraine with maximum available capabilities in terms of air defenses, and to begin supplying for real long-range weapons that Ukraine needs to get at targets, not just onesies and twosies, but to seriously get at targets well deep inside Russia so that the Russians really do feel the effects of Ukrainian strikes. So, you know, it's a combination of holding the line, protecting Ukrainian cities and towns, and striking deep at Russia to demonstrate that this will not go unpunished beyond what Russia has already suffered by way of its own casualties. That's my optimistic scenario. And at this point, I don't even want to think about a pessimistic scenario. I'll leave that for Sam to describe.
Well,
go ahead, Sam.
I tend to agree with Eugene. I think Ukraine has the capacity, has the technological capacity to cause Russia a lot of pain. Ukraine is gearing up to manufacture 10,000 different types of mid to long range drones, of which 1,000 are going to be long range kamikaze drones. Ukraine has the capacity to strike at Russian oil infrastructure, railroad infrastructure, military infrastructure, and other key facilities, including military bases. So this war can, in fact, be brought home to Russia on a much greater scale. And that's what Ukraine is aiming for. Ukraine can, in fact, hold the line, but it needs U.S. help. It needs Western help. Again, the most pessimistic scenario that I mentioned earlier is Russia fully absorbing Ukraine, because Putin does not believe that any part of independent Ukraine would be truly independent. He just wants to mop everything up simply because he believes if there's a country on its borders, it's either for him or it's against them, and there's no middle ground. So I think with that, I will also conclude that I do want to believe in an optimistic scenario. And again, as Eugene said, we have to give Ukrainians a lot of credit in putting up such incredible defense against Russia and manufacturing and developing so many technological solutions, which put them now ahead of most of the world when it comes to military high tech.
I agree with you. I have my fingers crossed. I'm hoping that enough people listen, pay attention, and reflect about what's going on over there and what's at stake, both for America's reputation as well as the safety and security of our allies. At the end of the day, we're only as good as our word. And I admire Speaker Johnson for making clear that the United States will abide by its word. Better late than never. And couldn't agree with you more, Sam and Eugene. Ultimately, just imagine the success Ukraine is going to be on the other side of this war, whether it's a part of Europe, whether it's a part of NATO, as well, international society. But there is a big job to be done. And I'm all for taking Russian resources in order to do that. There's hundreds of billions of dollars in Russian assets that are parked all over the world. We could do a better job of accessing those assets, and we certainly should be using those assets instead of making the Ukrainians pay for a war they didn't ask for to rebuild themselves. Anyway, gentlemen,
can I say
very
something
much.
Else?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead, Eugene, before we part.
I think that's the point about taking Russian assets is spot on. I think we need to be realistic about the likelihood, almost certainty, that that issue is going to be litigated for a long time to come. And this should not be used, as some people have, I think, used it as a substitute for us and the Europeans providing immediate assistance to Ukraine. I would also say that we need to change our own mentality from thinking that this can be over in a year or two, or even in a few months, to thinking about it as the long-term state that Europe, our closest ally, will find itself in for years and decades to come. And that requires a completely different approach, completely different thinking about our security and their security.
Indeed. Very well said. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Always an honor and pleasure having you guys on the program. Looking forward to having you guys back on again. Until then, be well, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, HII, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. We'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.